Welcome to the Christchurch London podcast. This is a talk from our Sutton service. To find out about upcoming talks at each of our services, or to listen to other talks, please visit christchurchlondon.org.
Lovely. Well, we're looking at Luke chapter 6, verses 27 to 42 this morning. It's fitting, I guess, as we've just been looking at diversity, that we're now looking at loving our enemies and not judging. So let me read the passage to us. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If anyone slaps you on one cheek, turn them the other also. If anyone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to repay it in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting getting anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. He also told them this parable. Can the blind lead the blind? Will they both not fall in the pit? The student is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like their teacher. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, "Brother, let me take the speck out of your eye," when you fail yourself to see the plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the plank out of your eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. So this passage comes in this sort of continuing narrative of Jesus' Sermon on the Plain, similar to the Beatitudes that we read in Matthew 2, the Sermon on the Mount. And what we've just had previously before this was the explanation of blessings and woes. We've been learning kind of about God's economy, how God has set everything up. And this passage comes in as to what does this mean for us as people who are going to follow him. So let's take a little bit of context for the audience of the time. Remember that Luke, when he's writing this gospel, is not writing to a Jewish audience. He's doing some translation, writing to a Gentile one. But in doing so, trying to communicate this meta-narrative of Judaism and how Jesus fulfills the promises of the Old Testament. And in this passage, first focusing on loving our enemy, he's doing just that. But the context, too, that people listening to him have hopes and fears and dreams about what their land will be like. They're all hoping for a Messiah. And through the gospel, Luke is abundantly clear Jesus is that Messiah. He's the hope, not only for the Jewish people, but for the whole world. But Israel is, at this point, under occupation by Rome. And if you can remember back to the very start of our sermon series, we looked at what was considered valuable at the time, which was strength, which was might. If you were right and whatever, that meant that you were going to be strong and you had conquered your enemies, and therefore you could say what was and what wasn't good. The measure of greatness was not compassion. It was not kindness or sacrifice, as we, 2,000 years later today, would see as the highest of virtues. No. To be poor, to be oppressed, to be weak, meant that you were to be pitied. You were meant to be scorned. The people Jesus is speaking to are pitied and scorned by their oppressors. And sure, the Jews had come to some kind of collaboration with the Romans at this time, that they were allowed to continue worshipping Yahweh, but they were a subjugated people with occupiers around them who had the power that they could abuse and control them as they wished. And here are just some images of what maybe a contemporary occupation looks like. But we're really used to this idea of when you see occupation, we want to resist. We're thinking like we're waiting for a hero to come and take that on, to fight back. I mean, the audience too were really acquainted with that as being a trope that they would understand. It's only 150 years before Jesus is speaking here that you had the Maccabean Revolution when Judah Maccabee fought against to have temple worship restored to how it was when the Seleucid Empire were trying to say they were going to be Greek gods being worshipped. And they restored the temple to worshipping Yahweh. And that became part of Jewish culture. We read in John 10 about Jesus celebrating what we now call Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights. This was something that people knew. Even one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, would have been called Judas after Judah. This idea that actually we will restore something to the rightness by revolt, by fighting, by resisting physically. So there is this really strong hope. But Jesus saying, love your enemies, stands in stark contrast to that. It might have sounded a bit like madness to the audience. Enemies there to be vanquished, there to be fought, there to be resisted. Now, before Catherine Nishola, we all know Catherine Nishola, don't we? Before she went to Israel, which she tells us about every time she stands on this stage, I went there. So, yeah, Catherine got there first. I told her this earlier outside, and she was like, what, you went there? As if, like, you know, no one had ever gone there. But I went there as a... just out of university, as a sort of rather naive chap with a guitar, thought, you know what, I'll go over there. And the reason I went is I read this book, Lightforce, by Brother Andrew, who you might remember, also wrote God Smuggling, smuggled Bibles into the Soviet Union. And it was all about the Middle East conflict and how hope might be brought into that situation that seemed to be this protracted battle that is defining in our times. And so when I went over there, I went to go and stay in Bethlehem, so in the West Bank. And things that I did when I was there, one day I went on a peaceful protest. We were invited by a local farmer to go to his land that was at the bottom of a hill underneath a settlement that had been essentially requisitioned or taken by Israeli settlers. And he invited us to come and eat the grapes in his vineyard. So we all trooped over there and started eating grapes. I just remember the seeds, that they weren't seedless grapes. Do you remember that? We, like 20, 30 years ago, you just buy grapes and they always have seeds and you go like, Mum, can you get the seedless ones, please? Because they just, whatever, these had seeds in them. So I was thinking that at the same time. It shows how naive and stupid I was. There are some things that have never changed. But as I was standing there, the Israeli Defense Force came out of the settlement with all their guns, a little bit like the image maybe we saw earlier of the woman shouting into the face of the soldier. They came out and they stood around us, and we kept on eating the grapes, and the guy leading us was saying, well, we are here at the invitation of this farmer to eat these grapes, so we're going to stay here. They've got no right to move us. And I was thinking, oh, right, good. And they were taking photographs of us, and they were getting a bit closer with their guns, etc. And ultimately, we ended up leaving before anything really happened. We were there to be at peaceful protest. But I wrote back to the Bible College, and because I'd taken my guitar, because that's what I'm like, I sat down and I wrote a song called Occupied Grapes, which one day, if you're lucky enough, you'll hear me play, or unfortunate enough if you ask Pat. Pat, if you don't know, is my wife, and she has to endure me playing songs, and that's one of the better ones. There are some really bad ones. But one of the lines I'd sort of put in it said, this doesn't look much like love to me. And I was thinking, well, surely isn't that what Jesus said? So I can't really judge what is being said and what I've seen in front of me of these soldiers coming out and what's happening in the geopolitics of Israel-Palestine, essentially sort of battle between Judaism and maybe Islam presently there. I can't really judge that by what Jesus said, can I? But I then went looking into the Old Testament, and in Leviticus 19:34, which is echoed again in Deuteronomy 10, it says this, you shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as a native amongst you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And for good emphasis, I am the Lord your God. God's saying that. Later when I was there, I went to a Messianic church in Jerusalem that was called King of Kings. And it was a, you know, basically Hillsong in Israel is how it felt. But then at the end of the service, I remember we were praying for protection from the Palestinians who wanted to destroy them. But I was thinking, I'm staying with the Palestinians. I'm going back there tonight to stay with our brothers and sisters. That picture of Natalie and her mum saying, we are one church. This is diversity. You know, this is glorious here. What we had there, it felt actually really, really far apart. And I couldn't understand who are our enemies and who are our brothers and sisters. And I feel that tension as we approach this passage is really all too real. When we talk about taking specks out of our brother's eye, are they our brother? Are they our enemies? What happens? There's an ebb and flow here. But the other thing from this passage in Leviticus is Israel were called to be a light unto the Gentiles, a demonstration of God's goodness and his love. But in contrast, Jesus is speaking to a people in Israel who have not become that. When he says to love your enemies, to pray for them, to go out of your way for them, it's doing that because they are not fulfilling that calling. So let's look a bit closer at what Jesus is saying. All of this comes out of a warning in verse 26. It says, "Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets." And I think that says something to both the people listening there, if they're following Jesus, but also to us. Don't try and please everybody. If we're following Jesus, we can expect that we will have enemies. We're living by a different economy, God's economy, not the economy of the world. So enemies will come and go. Our challenge is to continue to love them and to do good to them. And we're not waiting at all in this for a feeling of love. When we feel ready to pray for something, that something will happen inside us that we will want to do this. No, we are to do this in spite of our feelings, to do something that feels really unnatural. Jesus is also calling us to be willing to suffer wrongdoing, willing to be humiliated and not to retaliate. He says, if someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other to them also. Now, there's good reason to consider that this isn't just talking about a physical act, but actually this is when someone slaps you on the cheek, that is like someone has insulted you. But equally, it could be that someone has assaulted you too. But when that insult or assault happens, what course of action we take probably depends a little bit on our personality. Maybe we could retaliate. We can meet fire with fire. We'll do the same back. Maybe we can escalate. You know, you've done something to me. Well, I'm going to go a little bit harder so you won't then do that again. You'll learn and not come back. Or maybe we will retreat to try and avoid conflict. Three really common responses to when we have an insult or something towards us. And I think my favorite of those is retaliate. You know, just meet them back at the same level. Yeah. But the thing, none of those responses will work, will they? They don't solve what's happened with that insult. They're just going to either perpetuate the same thing, that same level, or they're going to deepen it and make it go further. So Jesus is saying, turn the other cheek. When it's retold in Matthew's gospel, it comes, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other to him also. Jesus is drawing a contrast with the old law, which at best could seek parity in terms of restitution. Jesus is suggesting something totally different. Turning your cheek, you're saying, well, you can do it again if you want. Or maybe you want to rethink the choice that you just made. Is there a different path for us to take that won't lead to this becoming the same perpetual thing? He goes on, if someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. So imagine you're a first century Jew, again, under this occupation. If someone takes your coat, that is likely to be an abuse, isn't it? I can have control over you. I can subjugate you and make you do whatever. Give me your coat. So we can try then, if someone does that to us, to pretend we're okay with it. Yeah, have my coat. Yeah, that's okay. Sneak away. We're okay. Don't worry. Yeah, no, don't bother us. But in one way, if we do that, we're either deluding ourselves that the anger of having something taken from us wrongfully is just going to be left there. We're actually becoming complicit within that abuse because we can't do anything to stop that. How do you make a change from just allowing this thing to perpetuate? So in the law, you couldn't ask somebody, in the Mosaic law, you couldn't ask somebody for their cloak. But Jesus says, well, if somebody does ask you, give them your shirt too, because your shirt was freely yours to give. By giving that, you're being able to take something that has been seen as abuse and turning it on its head. You're saying, that is something that has just now happened, but I can elevate. I can do something different. And by giving that which is mine, I'm setting out a different course. I'm transforming your theft and oppression into an act of generosity. And in doing so, no doubt, I'm also putting a fair share of shame upon them that I've now given something of my nakedness as a response to what they've done. But it's our way of gaining control over hate, taking that abuse and transforming it for something that could well be good. I think of this much like how forgiveness is so important, not just for the other person, but really for us. If we forgive, we are able to lighten the burden upon ourselves, and that's where the real freedom comes from, in forgiveness. Then Jesus says, give to everyone who asks, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Now, I remember several years ago that the UK government announced that their aid budget was no longer just going to be given how it was before. It was now going to be given to back up our foreign policy, to really help us do what Britain wanted to achieve in the world. And again, I said I'm naive sometimes. I look like I'm really wise and sensible. But I was like, gosh, that's so unjust. I felt such a spirit of guardian, like, oh, no, how terrible that you could do this, government. But actually what they were doing was something that has been common all the time. Like, governments have given aid in order to achieve what they wanted to do. They were just being honest about it. But the thing that they said as their justification for why they were going to make the aid budget try and support the foreign policy was because they understood that generosity, we were known around the world for our aid. That was seen as being good. So even if they weren't actually being that generous, they knew the perception of generosity had the power to change things. So the implication of all these things that Jesus is saying is that parity, fairness, getting even, whatever it is, that's not to be our end game, because it isn't actually an end game. If we respond with generosity, though, towards others that they don't deserve, we can change the game entirely and create new possibilities. Do to others as you'd have them do to you. That famous golden rule. Now, this wasn't new, as Jesus is saying that. He didn't coin it. It had been part of rabbinic tradition before, but maybe in a more limited sense. Rabbi Hillel, who was a contemporary at the time, was reported as saying, what is hateful to you, do not do to anyone else. What is hateful to you, do not do to anyone else. This is the whole law, and the rest is commentary. Go and learn it. But Jesus expands on that and changes it to make it into a positive action, rather than don't do this if it's hateful to you. It's actually saying, go and treat others how you would like to be treated. Step out of that place of what you can give to somebody else, rather than make sure that you've just done the right thing yourself. And one of the commentaries I read put it like this: this is the difference between not breaking the speed limit or seeing a stranded motorist and going and trying to do the help them in their situation. I can keep the law myself, or I can help somebody else flourish. It's an attitude that the best for us in front of God is not just trying to not do wrong ourselves, but trying to seek opportunities to do good. This is the rubric of the kingdom of God. We then move on to the next bit of this bit about what credit is that to you. I find this bit quite powerful. Jesus says, in contrast to those around us, like, if you love those who love us, what credit is that to you? If you do good to those who do good, if you lend to your friends, expect to be paid, what credit is that to us? Now, probably like some of you, our mortgage is up for renewal next year, yeah? And much as I might hope, Nationwide aren't going to turn around and say, well, what credit is that for us to receive back what you actually owe us? We want to be really virtuous, Mr. Copeland. You know what we're going to allow you. I mean, I take staying on the same rate, to be honest, that I've got at the moment. I don't want them just to cancel the debt. But, you know, they're not going to do that, sadly. They aren't going to look virtuous when they receive my inflated payments. But that is the normal economy that we live in, isn't it? We give something, we expect something in return. But Jesus says, lend without expecting anything in return. Lend without expecting anything in return. That sounds very much to me like another word. Do you know what I mean? Sounds a bit like give. Lend without expecting anything in return. And I know in my life, I've tried to teach my family and friends, you know, when they bought me presents, you know, write the thank you note. Oh, no, I'm not going to write the thank you note. I'm just teaching them to give without expecting anything in return. I've been quite studious about that, actually. If any of you were at our wedding, you didn't get one of those presents. So that's why there are very few people who are at our wedding here today, because turns out they were sinners expecting something in return. But no. Yeah, I get fewer presents now. It's much easier. And then I just now say thank you to people because I live around them or whatever, because it's easier. Maybe not as exciting. But we are to give. That's our expectation. If we get something in return, what a blessing that is. But if we do anything in the hope of receiving something, well, then that's just a transaction. We don't live for transactions. We live for transformation. And Jesus says, if we do these things, then our reward will be great. And it's not in what we're going to receive back, but it is that we get to be called children of the Most High. Because he's kind to the ungrateful and the wicked, which is good news for me, and probably you guys too. He's kind to us, and then we're called be merciful, just as our Father is merciful. So Jesus is calling us to be like him. And what he's saying isn't just a set of sayings for us to live our lives by, but actually it is a picture of what his life is to become after this time. If we want to know what loving our enemies looks like in practice, we look to Jesus. He who lives with a clear focus on what his purpose was, to be the living embodiment of the Father's love to the world. Nothing else matters. First, we've had the slap. Well, Jesus is ridiculed and is insulted. He's called a bastard. He's called a drunkard. He's called a glutton, one who eats with sinners. Mad. He's called a blasphemer. And yet he never retaliates. Jesus is misrepresented. He's hounded by the religious leaders and the teachers of the law, trying to trip him up. But he doesn't give in to their little word battles. He's slandered. He's maligned. He has lies spoken about him, even when he's in front of the Sanhedrin and could plead for his life, and no doubt, like every other time, be able to defeat them. He is silent in that moment. And then when he's on the cross, his clothes are taken, his cloak is divided amongst the soldiers looking at him. When he's left in nakedness and friendliness, the words that come from his mouth are this: but not my will, your will be done, in the Garden of Gethsemane. When his life is asked of him, he freely gives it. He doesn't hold it back. Then as his cloak is being separated, he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. In the face of this injustice, he is asking and praying for those people who have become his enemies. And then he says, truly, I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. To the man on the cross next to him, he said, we deserve this. He shows mercy to someone who doesn't deserve it and transforms his eternity. It's hard. Is Jesus calling us to go to the same lengths? I mean, surely not. I'm sure many of you have heard of Richard Wurmbrand, who was a Romanian Jew who grew up around communism and indeed became a devoted communist himself. He actually spent time in prison for being a communist. But he was ultimately became a Christian alongside his wife and then ended up in prison because he was going to speak out against the persecution of Christians by the government of the day. He was beaten and tortured again and again. And that's all recorded in his book, Tortured for Christ. But he lived a life of grace towards his captors despite the hatred that was turned towards him. In Tortured for Christ, he tells that the beatings that his fellow prisoners would endure, but they had this different attitude in them. They didn't harbor bitterness. And you can see also just him in Congress in the US later after he'd been released, showing the wounds that he had received at the hands of his persecutors. But he says this of prison. It was strictly forbidden to preach to other prisoners. It was understood that whoever was caught doing this received a severe beating. But a number of us decided to pay the price for the privilege of preaching. So we accepted their terms. It was a deal. We preached and they beat us. We were happy preaching. They were happy beating us. So everyone was happy. What a macabre thing to say that we're laughing at something so genuinely horrific. Because elsewhere he says this: I've seen Christians in communist prisons with 50 pounds of chains on their feet, tortured with red hot iron pokers, in whose throats spoonfuls of salt had been forced, being kept afterward without water, starving, whipped, suffering from cold, and prayed with fervor for the communists. This is humanly inexplicable. It is the love of Christ which was poured into their hearts. I find the story of those martyrs just so incredibly daunting because of what they've endured so marvelously. I'm not sure I would do the same. I might hope I would, but you know what? I think I'm possibly more like those brothers and sisters in Jerusalem, praying for protection against the people who could be my enemy and not seeing that they are actually my brother. My own fear could take over. But this is the central theme of Luke's gospel, isn't it? The love that we have received, that we get to be called children of God. He's writing this to a Gentile audience, remember, who've known that the people of Israel have been God's chosen people, but actually he's expanding this and showing that Jesus is opening the way for them too, for everybody to be called family of God. And that harks back to that first verse, doesn't it, that we looked in Leviticus. To be treated among the alien who lives amongst you, who sojourns amongst you, to treat them, love them like yourself. Because we're adopted into this family. You are chosen, you are loved, you are accepted, despite all that you have done to be God's enemy, whether that was outright rebellion against him, or whether that's been more subtle indifference. God loves you, God loves me with a passion that cannot be adequately explained despite knowing all our worst moments. And then the second part of this, it continues to look at judging. Sorry, that was just the bit about loving your enemy. But you're enduring well. Well done. But it's really closely linked to loving our enemies and not judging. So we're called to be merciful just as our Father is merciful in the preceding line. And I think in the last few weeks, we've seen this sort of play out, haven't we? We've seen Philip Schofield in the media, a man who has been judged by media, judged by people, looking in at him, all having opinions around him for a very sordid affair. And I followed along. I've been drawn into it myself, and I guess some of you have too, even if you wouldn't maybe want to admit it. But at times it's felt voyeuristic, waiting for the next statement to be released, or look at the interview and then go through the dissection of what did or didn't that mean. It's like we didn't have anything better to do. And I wonder, why do we do that as a society? Why do I want to do that? Is that because I might feel better seeing someone else at their lowest, that I can feel superior to them? To take away some of that shame that I have myself about I'm not what I want to be? Or maybe it's that I can't marry up what I've just heard with what I've been led to believe beforehand. And we're not immune to that at all in the church, are we? Church leaders who get caught in adultery or doing wrong. Plenty of pastors. Maybe you also have podcasts written about them and played out, and we'll listen to those and discuss that and talk about it. What did you think? Have you heard the latest episode? We can gossip, we can judge so, so easily and have a veneer of respectability over that. And one of his fellow presenters, Alison Hammond, went on shortly after when she was stepping in, and she said on national TV, she said, my mum, we always say to this me, Al, use the Bible as your sat-nav. And she says, well, in the Bible, she's got a Brummie accent, doesn't she? Yeah. In the Bible, it says, he was without sin, cast the first stone. Because she knows that she's loved this person who's felt like they have been family, but she was in conflict and trying to make those things together. And it really encapsulates what this passage, I think, is trying to get at. But the passage says, do not judge. But often the world stops there. Jesus says, yeah, don't judge. So therefore we must be accepting and celebrate everything in front of us. You know, like, you do me, I'll do me, you do you, we'll all be fine. You hear that said so often, don't you? But that's not what the passage is saying. Instead, Jesus is making this conditional statement. Do not judge and you will not be judged. Don't condemn and you won't be condemned. Forgive and you'll be forgiven. He isn't calling us to be accepting of everything and approving of all. Instead, he's leading us to be mindful of our own inner landscape. What's going on inside of us? He's raising the bar from being outward performance, looking like everything's okay, maybe what you were saying, and elevating that internal integrity. If we judge, we will be judged according to our standard. If we condemn, we will be condemned according to our standard. And if we don't forgive, how can we expect to be forgiven? It may be that often we can focus on others' faults, and maybe this happens at work, maybe this happens in marriage, maybe this happens in your relationships, maybe this is with your kids, maybe it's with your pastors, your leaders. We can look at other people's faults, be critical. We can focus on their worst moments. We can judge what we consider to be their hidden motives, or we can jump to conclusions. And we do all of this without first having had a long, honest, deep, hard look at ourselves. But how would we act in the same situation? How would we act if we had their same context? And maybe, if we're being honest, we wouldn't act as we'd like to think we would. We're very good at giving ourselves a free pass on that one. Oh, in this situation, I would do that. Yeah, because I'm great, me. If you know me, I'm not. We find that really hard. See, hypocrisy is not an option for us. Hypocrisy is what ruins the world. Jesus says elsewhere, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you hypocrites. You're like whitewashed tombs. You look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside, you are full of bones of the dead and everything unclean." This is part of Jesus' wider challenge to the Pharisees too, who would set laws for the people on the outside for them to live that would govern all their lives so that they could be blameless by not doing the right thing in front of God, be unsullied by the world. But in doing so, they would create a burden of restriction rather than freedom and life. And we'll look in a few weeks about the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is just an ideal story to be able to look deeper at that issue. The law was not intended to stifle compassion, but yet we've been so easy to take it in the wrong direction, and we live by our own law today too and do very similar things. Then Jesus says, well, who are you trying to emulate? That's a question for all of us today too, isn't it? And he's being quite intentionally funny here. Can the blind lead the blind? Well, no, it's a joke. They're going to fall in a pit. You know, you can imagine that's the punchline, or the penny drops, or the rabbi drops. I don't know. But a disciple is not above their teacher. But everyone who's trained will be like his teacher. You see, if you look to the Pharisees, you can only ever be as good as them. You can't hope to go to something of wisdom and transform beyond it. You will be limited by it. So who are we looking to be our teachers? We're here in church on Sunday, but are we really looking at the sages of our time? Are we looking to our friends to be like them so we fit in? Are you looking at the wisdom of TikTok? Some of you are. Or are we looking to Jesus? Commonly, we then move on to the last story of the speck of in someone in your brother's eye and the plank in your own. Commonly, I think we've got so used to using this as shorthand of saying, don't judge, because then you'll be judged. And we kind of stop there. It's like a line of defense that don't come near me because you hypocrite, you stay over there. I'm fine doing me. You do you. Yeah, look at that plank in your eye. It's amazing when you've got a speck in your eye that you can still see planks in other people's eyes. I don't, whatever. But actually, the more I've looked at this, and with the help of my wonderful community group too, and some of the conversations we've had, big up, guys, seen that actually this little section hinges on the line first. First, take the plank out of your own eye. Because we are called to be people who will go and take the speck out of our brother's eye, after we have first done that to ourselves. And this image here is well, Luke himself, he was a doctor. He was a physician. And so you wouldn't trust somebody coming at you if they had a plank in their eye because their peripheral vision is going to be bad. You know, if you've only got one eye, your depth perception is not going to be quite there. I'm going to be pretty ham-fisted and potentially blind you or damage you further if I come to try and do something that is going to be helpful. We've got to get ourselves right first. When doctors go into surgery, they clean themselves and make sure they know everything that they need to know. Because to not do that, they would be being negligent. So Jesus is saying unambiguously in this that both the plank and the speck need to be taken out. We're coming in a little bit to land, but I was reminded a little bit about this, the letter and the spirit of the law. We've got a little video to look at. The Ashes is going on at the moment. Has anyone seen it? Did anyone stop working for 5 days last week to just listen to cricket? Or was that just me? Yeah, just me, fine. Okay, well, anyway, the Ashes was going on last week. And I was reminded in listening to one of things, like, quite why the Australians maybe don't like our fantastic bowler, Stuart Broad. And have we got a little clip, a YouTube clip to come up now? I think I'll keep talking a little bit. Well, you see, they really don't like him. Is this about to come? And then I'll see what you think about it. There we go. Marvellous. Let's play. I'll move out of the way.
When Australia's frustration turned to anger.
Oh, he's gone this time. Not the best delivery. And he's still there, Stuart Broad. What's he standing there for? They've all appealed. It looked as if he just nicked it through the keeper. Oh, my goodness me. speechless. The audacity of he just walked up the pitch and had a word with his non-striking batter.
With no reviews at his disposal, the skipper let fly.
The skipper let fly was something that we can't now say here, probably. Stuart Broad got out, and he didn't get out. What's that about? What are you watching on YouTube? Weird stuff. Wow. Anyway, sorry. He gets out, and he doesn't walk. And that's audacious. He should walk, right? There's this like unwritten rule in cricket. If you do the wrong thing, they talk about the spirit of the game. You should just, you're out, go. Like, that's the right thing to do, but no, he doesn't. And interestingly, afterwards, ex-professionals, even like the Australian captain, say, no, we don't blame him for doing that. No, absolutely not. The umpire didn't give him out. Like, why would we blame Stuart Broad for going to do that? The great Shane Warne even said, I was impressed. I was so impressed by him. Yeah, that, you know, he just like, usually you nick it, you're going to go, oh, no, and then you're going to walk. But him just to stand there, oh, that was seriously impressive. What? Our great Ian Botham even says in the interview afterwards. Well, for hundreds of years, this has been happening, if the Ashes. The Ashes haven't been going for hundreds of years, but he did say, for hundreds of years, this has been happening. I think if anyone thinks he should walk, they haven't played in the Ashes, have they? No, because he's cheated. See, in the letter of the law, he doesn't have to walk because the umpire didn't give him out, and Australia couldn't review that to overturn something that clearly was obviously he is now out. England went on to win that test. I probably accept a load of that happening over the next few weeks if we won the Ashes back, but that wouldn't be right, would it? See, in the letter of the law, he can get away with it, but we know that it is against the spirit of the law. And that's kind of Jesus' critique of the Pharisees here. You're trying to crack a walnut with a sledgehammer with the things that you do. This needs to be balanced. So, let's come finally to the application for us. What are we to do about this? Are we to be lovers? People who don't judge? Now, I don't think any of this is easy at all. In the last 2 years, I've been managing the divorce of my father from my stepmother, who left him during first lockdown. He's got Parkinson's dementia and he's lost mental capacity, so I've become his litigation friend and gone through that divorce, and graciously, it's getting towards an end now. But I've had lies written about me in court documents, things maligning me, my motives, whether I actually love my own father. Sure, he wasn't always a great dad sometimes, but all these things written, they're sort of put out there. And I've really learned a little bit more, like, well, I felt like I really had an enemy. It's been clear to me, like, this stuff is coming against me. But I look back and think, I've also had enemies at other times in my life, in work, when I haven't maybe felt I've had the promotion I was expecting. Maybe that person wasn't an enemy, but I realised there's that sort of antipathy there that's happened too. But through this particularly, I've been reminded of the need to forgive again and again. My stepmother, forgive what's happening. It isn't all her fault. And that's been really hard, particularly as new things come to light or the next saga that has come up and go like, oh, I've got to go back and forgive again. And I don't want to. I want to be angry. I've stayed awake at night sort of mulling over this, cogitating on this, getting riled up. And I've been thinking at this sort of clash in me of thinking like, but I need to forgive. But gosh, I feel so hard about this. This is too much. This is not easy. But what are we to do about it? And I think that there are three steps we need to take. One is to understand how loved we are. And from that position, two, to be able to try and exercise, to practice compassion. And the third thing I think we need to do is make ourselves vulnerable. So, understand how loved we are. Understand how loved you are. You're loved so much by God. He is merciful. He's merciful to the ungrateful and the wicked, which is good news for us. There's a song we've sung occasionally that I've played. I am your beloved. You bought me with your blood. And on your hands written out my name. I am your beloved, one the Father loves. Your mercy has defeated all my shame. And the bridge says, the one who loved me best is the one who knows me best is the one who loves me most. There is nothing I've done that could change the Father's love. We need to believe that if we are to live out being able to love others and not judge. To know how much you have been saved, what you have been brought out from. And that comes back to this Old Testament passage in Leviticus, of you shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native amongst you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. The heart of this verse is the equation, love, for you were. He's bringing back to the sense that you were in Egypt. You suffered great subjugation, but at one point, Egypt too was also your salvation, if you remember the book of Joseph, when there was widespread famine. Started out something good that then really went wrong. And it feels to me there is a call to, when we look back at our own lives, our own Egypts, what have we been saved from? Where there has been some good there too as well, to remember that it isn't all wrong. But we can also see how God's salvation has transformed some of those things. You wouldn't blame the people just to look at the Exodus and remember all of the terrors of Pharaoh, would you? But you wouldn't want somebody to stay always going back to that. You'd want somebody to come to say, well, I can transform this by love. Remember the grace that you have received when you think of your Egypts. And finally, I think we need to become more vulnerable. I love the message or the word that Jill brought. To be honest, I think that applies for me a lot. Probably applies to lots of us. But if you feel like that, you're not alone. Well, I'm going to stand here too and say, like, yeah, some of that applies to me. Because I'm not all I want to be. And what you see outside isn't the same thing happening inside here. I've got planks. But I want to help you take the specks out of your own eye. How am I going to achieve that? By being vulnerable, sharing the things inside of me. And in doing so, I think we will learn the empathy, learn the compassion of what it is like to be on the side of being judged. When we make ourselves vulnerable, we open ourselves up to potential judgment. If we are to be people who will not judge, we need to know how that might feel. We can't just do it in principle and say, well, I'm not going to judge. We need to understand something so that we can internalize that and make sure we live our lives cautious of the fact where we might trample over somebody and judge them. In practicing vulnerability, we're making space for people to come alongside us too, to practice their compassion too, and to be able to demonstrate back to God's love for us. To close, we must understand how loved we are. None of the things that we've said make any sense without being able to grasp that. If you come here with a sense of shame inside you, something that holds you back from being known, from that sense of freedom, maybe we need to go away from here having found somebody in church that we can share that with, so that we can be known, so that there isn't going to be space for us to be hypocrites. Because if someone knows us, it's a lot harder to do that. But there is real freedom. And that's the calling that is upon our lives. That we would be people who are known by the love that we have because of who loved us first and how we then love one another. Would the band like to come back up? I should have said that a little while ago. But you are so loved. I'd encourage you to, whilst the band play the last song, if you want somebody to come alongside and pray with you, to be vulnerable, to say, look, I could do with something. I don't know whether you can articulate exactly what I want, but I need to come and say, I want to be more open. Find somebody to say that with. This could be a little start. Because in doing so, we will find the opportunities to become people who can love. People who do not need to judge. Shall I pray for us? Jesus, we thank you. We thank you that you have given us our hope and our future, that we get to be known as children of God. We thank you, Father, that you are merciful upon us, however we feel about ourselves. You have transformed our situation from one of shame to one of having an eternity of glory with you, where we will get to say, worthy. You are worthy of it all. We will stand before your throne. What a transformation. What a transformation. Let us understand deeply your love for us, what that means, how wide, how vast, how strong it is. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.